Chapter 14. The Kyrenae Plain. Some say men continually war against circumstances, but I say they perpetually flee. What are the works of men if not a momentary respite, a hiding place soon to be discovered by catastrophe? Life is endless flight before the hunter we call the world. Ecyanus the Eighth, 111, Aphorisms. Spring, 4111, Year of the Tusk, the Nansur Empire. The warbling of a lone woodlark, like an aria against the rush of wind through the forest canopy. Afternoon, she thought. The birds always snooze in the afternoon. Serwe's eyes fluttered open, and for the first time in a long while, she felt at peace. Beneath her cheek, Kellis's chest rose and fell to the rhythm of his sleep. She had tried to join him on his mat before, but he'd always resisted, to appease the Skilvendi, she had thought. But this morning, after a dark night of travel, he had relented, and now she savored the press of his strong body against hers, the drowsy sense of sanctuary afforded by his sheltering arm. Kellis, do you know how much I love you? Never had she known such a man who knew her, and yet still loved. For an idle moment, her eyes followed the rafters of the immense willow they slept beneath. Limbs arched against the depths of further limbs, parted like a woman's legs, and then parted again, winding away into great skirts of leaves that bobbed and dipped beneath the sunlit wind. She could feel the soul of the great tree, brooding, sorrowful, and infinitely wise, the rooted witness of innumerable suns. Serwe heard splashing. Shirtless, the Skilvendi squatted at the river's edge, cupping water in his left hand and gingerly rinsing the wound on his forearm. She watched him through the blur of lashes, feigning sleep. Scars hooked and creased his broad back, a second record to match the scars banding his arms. As though aware of her scrutiny, the forest grew hushed, its silence colored by the stern grandeur of trees. Even the solitary bird fell quiet, yielding to the slurp and trickle of Neur's bathing. For perhaps the first time, she felt no fear of the Skilvendi. He looked lonely, she thought, even gentle. He lowered his head to the water and began rinsing his long black hair. The filmy surface of the river slowly passed before him, bearing twigs and bits of fluff. Near the far bank, she glimpsed the ripples of a water bug skimming across the river's glassy back. Then she saw the boy on the far side. At first, she glimpsed only his face, half hidden in the crook of a mossy deadfall. Then she saw slender limbs, as still as the branches screening them. "Do you have a mother?" she thought. But when she realized he watched the Skilvendi, a sudden terror struck her. Go away, run. Plainsman, Kellis said softly. Startled, the Skilvendi turned to him. Tu safar o tu gring mutayaga, Kellis said. Serwe felt his nod brush the top of her head. The Skilvendi followed his gaze and peered into the shadowy recesses of the far bank. For a breathless moment, the boy stared back at the plainsman.
Come here, child, Neur said over the hushed water. I've something to show you.
The boy hesitated, both wary and curious.
No, you must run, run.
Come,
Neur said, lifting his hand and motioning with his fingers.
You're safe.
The boy stood from behind his shield of fallen branches, tense, uncertain.
Run!
Serwe cried. The boy flickered into the wood, flashing between white sun and deep green shadow.
Fucking wench! Neur snarled.
He exploded across the waters, knife drawn. At the same instant, Kellis was gone as well, rolling to his feet and plowing through the Skilvendi's wake.
Kellis!
She cried, watching him sprint beneath the far canopy.
Don't let him kill him!
But a sudden horror struck her breathless, an unaccountable certainty that Kellis also meant the child harm.
You must suffer him, Serwe.
Her body still groggy, she stumbled to her feet and plunged into the dark water. Her bare feet skidded across the slick rocks, but she hurled herself forward, falling just short of the far bank. Then she was up, soaked in cold, running across gravel, lunging through brush into the sun-dappled gloom. She ran like something wild, bounding over the matted leaves, leaping ferns and fallen branches, following their fleet shadows deeper through the screen of dark trees. Her feet felt weightless, her lungs bottomless. She was breath and vaulting speed, nothing more.
Bastushri!
Echoed through the hollows of the wood.
Bastushri!
The Skilvendi calling to Kellis. But from where? She caught herself on the trunk of a young ash. She looked around, heard the distant crash of someone barreling through underbrush, but saw nothing. For the first time in weeks, she was alone. They would kill the boy if they caught him, she knew, to prevent him from telling anyone what he had seen. They traveled through the Empire secretly, made fugitives by the scars that striped the Skilvendi's arms. But she wasn't a fugitive, she realized. The Empire was her land, or at least the land her father had sold her to.
I'm home. There's no need to suffer him.
She pressed herself away from the tree, and with blank eyes and an itching heart, began walking at right angles to her previous path. She walked for some time, once hearing faint shouts through the ambient rush of leaves and the wind. I'm home, she would think. But then thoughts of Kellis would assail her, curiously smeared into images of the Skilvendi's brutality. Kellis's eyes, as she spoke, pinched by concerns or suppressed smiles, the thrill of his hand encompassing her own, as though this modest intimacy bespoke an impossible promise. And the things he said, words that had sounded her to the pith, had rendered her squalid life a portrait of heartbreaking beauty.
Kellis loves me. He's the first to love me.
Then, with a shaking hand, she felt her belly through her soaked shift. She began shivering. The others, the women originally taken with her by the Manawati, were dead, she imagined. She did not mourn them. A small, peevish part of her had actually celebrated the death of the Gonum wives, the ones who had strangled her baby, her blue baby. But wherever she went in the Empire, she knew there would be other Gonum wives. Serwe had always been keenly aware of her beauty, and for a time among her Nimbrakani kinsmen, she had thought it a great gift of the gods, an assurance that her future husband would be a man of many cattle. But here in the Empire, it ensured only that she would be a pampered concubine, despised by some Patrodomo's wives and doomed to give birth to blue babies. Her stomach was flat, but she could feel it. Feel the baby. Images of the Skilvendi's urgent fury assaulted her. Still, she thought, Kellis's child, our baby. She turned and began to retrace her steps. After a short time, Serwe realized she was lost and was once again terrified. She looked to the white glare of the sun through the shroud of vaulting branches and distant leaves, trying to determine north. But she couldn't remember which direction she'd initially come. Where are you? She thought, too afraid to call out. Kellis, find me, please. A sudden wail pealed beneath the canopies. The boy? Had they found the boy? But she realized this couldn't be. The cry had belonged to a man. What's happening? The thought of hoofs from across a low rise to her right heartened her. He comes. When he realized I was lost, he fetched the horses to better. But when the two horsemen broke the crest, her skin pimpled with dread. They galloped down the shallow slope, kicking up leaves and hummus, and then, astonished by her apparition, reined their charges to a rebellious stop. She recognized them immediately by their armor and insignia, common officers of the Kidrahil, an elite cavalry of the Imperial Army. Two of the Gonum sons had belonged to the Kidrahil. The younger, handsome one, looked almost as frightened as she was. He sketched an old wives' ward against ghosts above his horse's mane, but the older one grinned like a spiteful drunk.
a scythe-shaped scar hooked across his forehead, around a deep socket, then parsed his left cheek.
The Kidrahil here. Does that mean they're dead?
In her soul's eye, she saw the little boy peering from behind black branches.
Did he live? Did he warn? Is this my fault?
This thought, more than any fear of the men, paralyzed her. She hissed in terror, her chin lifting of its own volition, as though she were baring her throat to their sheathed weapons. Tears sketched her cheeks.
Run,
she frantically thought, but she couldn't move.
She's with them,
the scarred man said, still struggling with his lathered horse.
Who knows?
The other nervously replied.
She's with them. Peaches like this don't wander the woods alone. She don't belong to us, and she sure as hell ain't no goatherd's daughter. Look at her.
But the other had been gawking the entire time, at her bare legs, at the swell of her breasts beneath her shift, but especially at her face, as though afraid it would disappear if he glanced away.
But we haven't the time,
he said unconvincingly.
Fuck that,
the first spat.
We always have time to bugger something like this.
He dismounted with odd grace, staring at his comrade as though daring him to play a malicious trick.
Just follow me, his eyes said, and you'll see.
Cowed by something incomprehensible, the younger one followed his harsh companion's lead. He still stared at Serwe, his eyes somehow both shy and vicious. They were both fumbling with their iron and leather skirts, the one with a scar approaching her, the younger one hanging back with the horses. He was already desperately tugging at his flaccid member.
Maybe, he said in a curious voice, I'll just watch then. They're dead, she thought. I killed them.
Just watch where you blow your snot,
the other said, laughing, his eyes at once hungry and humorless.
You deserved this.
With thoughtless economy, the older man bared his dagger, clenched her woolen shift, and slit it open from neck to belly. Avoiding her eyes, he used the point to draw aside the cloth, revealing her right breast.
My,
he said, exhaling a thick breath. He reeked of onions, rotten teeth, and bitter wine. At last he met her terrified gaze. He raised a hand to her cheek. The nail of his thumb was bruised purple.
Leave me alone,
she whispered, her voice pinched by burning eyes and trembling lips. The impotent demand of a child tormented by other children.
Shh,
he said softly. He gently pressed her to her knees.
Don't be mean to me,
she murmured through tears.
Never,
he said, his voice stricken as though with reverence. With a creak of leather, he fell to one knee and buried his dagger in the forest floor. He was breathing heavily.
Sweet Sejanus,
he hissed. He looked terrified. She flinched from the shaking hand he slid beneath her breast. The first sobs racked her.
Please, 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 please.
One of the horses spooked. There was a sound, like an axe striking sodden deadwood. She glimpsed the younger horseman, saw his head lolling from a shank of neck, his falling torso spouting blood. Then she saw the Skilvendi, his chest heaving, his limbs greasy with sweat. The scarred man cried out, scrambling to his feet and scraping his longsword clear. But the Skilvendi seemed unconcerned by him. His murderous look sought her instead.
Has the dog hurt you?
He barked as much as asked. Serwe shook her head, numbly straightening her clothes. She glimpsed the knife pommel embedded in a whorl of leaves.
Listen to me, barbarian,
the Kidrahil said hastily. Tremors passed through his sword.
I had no idea she was yours. No idea.
Nayor fixed him with glacial eyes, a strange humor in the set of his thick jaw. He spat on the corpse of his comrade, grinned wolfishly. The officer moved away from Serwe, as though to disassociate himself from his crime.
Come now, friend. Take the horses. All yours.
To Serwe, it seemed that she'd floated to her feet, that she'd flown at the scarred man,
and that the knife had simply appeared in the side of his neck. Only his frantic backhand knocked her back to earth. She watched him fall to his knees, his bewildered hands fumbling at his neck. He threw an arm backward as though to ease his descent, but he toppled, lifting his back and hips from the ground, kicking up leaves with one foot. He turned to her, retching blood, his eyes round and shining, begging her. The Skilvendi crouched above him and casually jerked the knife from his neck. Then he stood, apparently oblivious to the blood jetting, like the final squirts of a little boy's piss, she thought inanely, first across his stomach and waist, and then across his tanned knees and shins. Through the Skilvendi's legs, the dying man still watched her, his eyes becoming glassy with lethargic panic. Nayor loomed above her, broad shoulders and narrow hips, long, chiseled arms banded by scars and veins, wolf skin hanging between his sweaty thighs. For a moment, her terror and hatred deserted her. He'd saved her from humiliation, perhaps even death. But the memory of his brutalities could not be silenced. The feral splendor of his frame became something famished, preternaturally deranged, and he would not let her forget. Clamping his left hand about her throat, he yanked her, gagging from the ground, and threw her against a tree. With his right, he brandished the knife, raising it menacingly before her face, holding it still just long enough for her to glimpse her reflection distorted across its blood-smeared length. Then he pressed the tip against her temple. It was still warm. She winced at its prick, felt blood pool in her ear. He glared at her with an intensity that made her sob. His eyes, white blue and white, cold with the utter absence of mercy, bright with the ancient hatreds of his race.
Please, don't kill me. Please.
That whelp you warned nearly cost us our lives, wench, he snarled. Do anything like that again and I will kill you. Try to flee again and I promise I'll murder the world to find you.
Never again. Never. I promise. I'll suffer you. I will.
He released her throat and seized her right arm, and for a moment she cringed as she wept, expecting a blow. When it did not come, she wailed aloud, choking on her own shuddering breaths. The very forest, the spears of sunlight through forking limbs, the trees like temple pillars, thundered with his anger.
I promise.
The Skilvendi turned to the scarred man who still writhed sluggishly against the forest floor.
You have killed him, he said, his accent thick. You know this?
Yes,
she said numbly, trying to compose herself.
God, what now?
With the knife, he cut a lateral line across her forearm. The pain was sharp and quick, but she bit her lip rather than cry out.
Swazond, he said in harsh, Skilvendi tones. The man you have killed is gone from the world, Sirwe. He exists only here, a scar upon your arm. It is the mark of his absence, of all the ways his soul will not move, and of all the acts he will not commit, a mark of the weight you now bear.
He smeared the wound with his palm, then clutched her hand.
I don't understand.
Serwe whimpered, as bewildered as she was terrified. Why was he doing this? Was this his punishment? Why had he called her by name?
You must suffer him.
You are my prize, Serwe. My tribe.
When they found Kellis at the camp, Serwe leapt from the scarred man's horse, which had shied from crossing the river, and bound through the waters toward him. And then she was in his arms, clutching him fiercely. Strong fingers combed through her hair. The hammer of his heart murmured in her ears. He smelled of sun-dried leaves and sturdy earth. Through her tears she heard, "Shh, child, you're safe now. Safe with me." So like her father's voice. The Skilvendi rode across the river leading her horse. He snorted aloud as he neared them. Serwe said nothing, but she stared at him with baleful eyes. Kellis was here. It was safe to hate him once again. Kellis said,
Bring out Togingas, kut multa tosfuira.
Though she knew nothing of Skilvendi, she was certain he had said,
She's yours no longer, so leave her alone.
Nayor simply laughed, then replied in Shaik,
We have no time for this. Kidrahil patrols usually number more than 50. We have killed only a dozen.
Kellis pressed Serwe away and held her shoulders firmly in his hands. For the first time, she noticed the arcs of blood speckled across his tunic and beard.
He's right, Serwe. We're in great danger. They'll hunt us now.
Serwe nodded, more tears flooding her eyes.
It's all my fault, Kellis, she hissed. I'm so sorry. But he was just a child. I couldn't let him die.
Nayor snorted once again.
The whelp warned no one, girl. What mere boy could escape a Dunyane?
A bolt of terror struck her.
What does he mean?
She asked Kellis, but now his own eyes brimmed with tears.
No.
In her soul's eye, she glimpsed the child, small limbs askew somewhere deep in the forest, sightless eyes searching for sky.
I did this.
Another absence where a soul should have moved. What acts would the nameless boy have accomplished? What kind of hero might he have been? Kellis turned away from her, overcome by grief. As though finding solace in urgent action, he began rolling his sleeping mat beneath the grand willow. He paused and, without looking at her, said in a pained voice,
You must forget this, Serwe. We haven't the time.
Shame. As though her innards had become cold water.
I forced this crime upon him, she thought, staring at Kellis as he bound their gear to his saddle.
Once again her hand found her belly.
My first sin against your father.
The Kidrahil horses, the Skilvendi said. We shall ride them to death first.
For the first 2 days, they eluded their pursuers with relative ease. Relying on the primeval forests that blanketed the headwaters of the River Phaeus, and the Skilvendi's martial acumen to preserve them. Nevertheless, the flight took a heavy toll on Serwe. Day and night, on horseback, negotiating steep gullies, galloping across stony slopes, and hazarding the innumerable tributaries of the Phaeus was nearly more than she could handle. By the first night, she was swaying on the back of her horse, struggling with both numb limbs and eyes that refused to stay open, while Nayor and Kellis led the way on foot. They seemed unconquerable, and it galled her that she was so weak. By the end of the second day, Nayor allowed them to make camp, suggesting that they had lost whatever pursuers they might have had. 2 things, he said, were in their favor. The fact that they traveled east, when any Skilvendi raiding party would surely withdraw to the Hethantis after meeting the Kidrahil, and the fact that he and Kellis had been able to kill so many after the colossal misfortune of encountering them in their hunt for the boy. Serwe was far too exhausted to mention the one she'd killed, so she rubbed the clotted blood on her forearm instead, surprised by the feeling of pride that flared through her.
The Kidrahil are arrogant fools, Nayor continued. 11 dead will convince them that the raiding party must be large. This means that they will be cautious in their pursuit and send out for reinforcements. It also means that if they encounter our eastward trail, they will think it a ruse and follow it west toward the mountains, hoping to pick up the trail of the main party.
That night, they ate raw fish he speared from a nearby stream, and despite her hate, Serwe found herself admiring the affinity between this man and the open wilds. For him, it seemed a place of innumerable clues and small tasks. He could guess approaching terrain from the sight and song of certain birds, and he could ease the strain on their horses by feeding them cakes of fungus scratched from the hummus. There was far more to him than abuse and murder, she realized. As Serwe marveled over her ability to savor food that would have made her vomit in her previous life, Nayor told them episodes from his many forays into the Empire. The westward provinces of the Empire, he said, offered them their only hope of throwing off their pursuers. They had been long abandoned because of the depredations of his kinsmen. Their peril would be far greater once they crossed into the great tracts of cultivated land along the lower Phaeus. And not for the first time, Serwe wondered why these men would risk such a journey. They resumed their trek in daylight, intending to travel into the following night. In early morning, Neyor felled a young doe, and Serwe took it to be a good omen, though the prospect of eating venison raw did not appeal to her. She found herself to be continuously hungry, but had ceased speaking of it because of the Skilvendi scowl. At midday, however, Kellis urged his mount even to hers and said,
"You're hungry again, aren't you, Serwe? How do you know these things?" she asked.
It never ceased to thrill her each time Kellis guessed her thoughts, and the part of her that held him in reverent awe would find further confirmation.
"How long has it been, Serwe?"
"How long has what been?"
she asked, suddenly fearful.
"Since you've been with child."
"But it's your child, Kellis, yours."
"But we've not yet coupled," he said gently.
Serwe suddenly felt bewildered, unsure as to what he meant, and more unsure still whether she had spoken aloud. But of course they had coupled. She was with child, wasn't she? Who else could be his father?
Tears swelled in her eyes.
"Kellis, are you trying to hurt me?"
"No, no," he replied. "I'm sorry, sweet Serwe. We'll stop to eat very soon."
She stared at his broad back as he rode ahead to join Neyor. She was accustomed to watching their brief exchanges and drew petty satisfaction from the moments of hesitation, even anguish, that would crack Neyor's weather-beaten expression. But this time she felt compelled to watch Kellis, to note the way the sun flashed through his blonde hair, to study the sumptuous line of his lips and the glitter of his all-knowing eyes. And he seemed almost painfully beautiful, like something too bright for cold rivers, bare rock, and knotted trees. He seemed... Serwe held her breath, fear for a moment that she might swoon.
"I didn't speak, and yet still he knew."
"I am the promise," Kellis had said above the long road of Skilvendi skulls.
"Our promise," she whispered to the child within her, "our God."
But could it be? Serwe had heard innumerable stories of the gods communing with men as men long ago in the days of the Tusk. This was scripture. This was true. What was impossible was that a god might walk now, that a god might fall in love with her, with Serwe, the daughter sold to House Gonum. But perhaps this was the meaning of her beauty, the reason she had suffered the venal covetousness of man after man. She was also something too beautiful for the world, something awaiting the arrival of her betrothed, Anasarimber Kellis. She smiled tears of rapturous joy. She could see him as he truly was now, radiant with otherworldly light, halos like golden disks shining about his hands. She could see him. Later, as they chewed strips of raw venison in a breezy stand of poplars, he turned to her and in her native tongue of Nimbrikani said, "You understand." She smiled, but was not surprised that he knew her father's language. He'd bid her speak it to him many times, not to learn, she now knew, but to listen to her secret voice, the one sheltered from the wrath of the Skilvendi.
"Yes, I understand. I'm to be your wife."
She blinked the tears from her eyes. He smiled with godlike compassion and tenderly stroked her cheek.
"Soon, Serwe. Very soon."
That afternoon they crossed a broad valley, and as they crested the summit of the far slopes, they caught their first glimpse of their pursuers. Serwe could not see them at first, only the outer skirt of sunlit trees along a distant stony defilade. Then she glimpsed the shadows of horses behind, their thin legs scissoring through the gloom, their riders hunched to avoid unseen branches. Abruptly, one appeared at the brink, the sun smearing his helm and armor bright white. Serwe shrank into the shadows.
"They seem confused," she said.
"They lost our trail along the stony ground," Neyor said grimly. "They're searching for the route we took down."
Afterward, Nayor increased their pace. With their train of horses in tow, they thundered through the wood, the Skilvendi guiding them down rolling slopes until they came to a shallow, gravelly stream. They then changed direction, riding downstream along the muddy banks, at times splashing through the stream itself until it joined a much larger river. The air was beginning to cool, and gray evening shadows had all but swallowed the open spaces. Several times, Serwe had thought she could hear the Kidrahil shouting through the forests behind them, but the ever-present sound of rushing waters made it difficult to be certain. Yet curiously, she felt unafraid. Though the elation she'd felt for the greater part of the day had vanished, the sense of inevitability had not. Kellis rode beside her, and his reassuring eyes never failed to find her the moment her heart weakened. "You have nothing to fear," she would think. "Your father rides with us."
"These forests," the Skilvendi said, pitching his voice to be heard over the river, "continue for a short time before thinning into pastures. We ride for as long as we can into dark without risking our horses or our necks. These men who follow us are not like the others. They are determined. They live their lives hunting and battling my people through these forests. They will not stop until they run us down. But once we clear the forest, our advantage lies in our extra horses. We will run them until they are dead. Our only hope is to race along the Fayas far ahead of any word of our coming and reach the Holy War."
Following his lead, they rode along the river until the moonlight transformed it into a ribbon of quicksilver through blue-backed stone and the looming dark of the surrounding forest. After a time, the moon lowered, and the horses began stumbling and shying from the path. With a curse, the Skilvendi bid them stop. Wordlessly, he began stripping the horses of their gear and tossing it into the river. Too weary for words, Serwe dismounted, stretched against the evening chill, and stared for a moment at the nail of heaven glittering amid clouds of paler stars. She glanced back the way they had come and was arrested by a far different glitter, a watery string of lights slowly crawling along the river.
"Kellis,"
she said, her voice croaking from disuse.
"I've already seen them,"
Nayor replied, heaving a saddle far out into the rushing river.
"The advantage of the pursuer, torches at night."
There was a difference in his tone, Serwe realized, an ease she'd never heard before, the ease of a workman in his element.
"They've been gaining ground," Kellis noted, "moving too quickly to be picking out our trail. They just follow the river. Perhaps we can use this to our advantage."
"You have no experience in these matters, Dunyane."
"You should listen to him,"
Serwe said, more hotly than she intended. Nayor turned to her, and though his expression was lost in the darkness, she could sense his outrage. Skilvendi tribesmen did not brook shrewish women.
"The only way we could use this to our advantage," he replied, his fury scarcely bridled, "is by striking through the forest. They would continue ahead, perhaps lose our trail altogether, but by sunrise they would realize their mistake. Then they would be forced to backtrack, but not all of them would do so. They know we are bent on traveling east, and they would know they were now ahead of us. They would send word ahead of our coming, and we would be doomed. Our only hope is to outrun them. Understand?"
"She understands, plainsman," Kellis replied.
Leading their horses on foot, they continued. Kellis guided them now, unerringly taking advantage of every stretch of open ground, so that at times Serwe found herself running. Several times she fell, tripping over something unseen, yet she always managed to recover herself before the Skilvendi could upbraid her. She was perpetually winded, her lungs burning, a cramp periodically knifing into her side. She was bruised, scraped, and so exhausted that her legs wobbled whenever she stood still. But there was no question of stopping, not so long as the string of torches prickled in the distance. Eventually, the river turned, cascading over a series of stone shelves. Under the starlight, Serwe glimpsed a great body of water ahead of them.
"The River Fayas,"
Nayor said.
Very soon we will ride, Serwe.
Rather than follow the tributary to the Phaeus, they veered to the right and plunged into the blackness of the forest interior. For the first while, Serwe could see almost nothing, and she felt as though she followed a train of sounds through a nightmarish tunnel of blackness jostling with blackness. Cracking twigs, snorting horses, the periodic stamping of hoofs. But gradually, a pallid twilight began etching details from the gloom. Slender trunks, deadfalls, the mosaic of leaves across the forest floor. The Skilvendi had spoken true, she realized. The wood was growing thinner. As dawn gathered on the eastern horizon, Neor called them to a halt. Clutched in the roots of an upturned tree, a great disk of earth reared above him.
Now we ride, he said. We ride hard.
At last she was off her feet, but her relief was short-lived. With Neor ahead and Kellis in the rear, they barreled through the brush. As the forest thinned, the latticed confusion of the canopy descended until it seemed they raced through it, lashed by innumerable branches. Through the staccato thud of hoofs, she heard the swell of morning birdsong. They broke from the oppressive brush and across the pastures at a gallop. Serwe cried out and laughed aloud, exhilarated by the sudden rush over open ground. Cool air numbed her stinging face and combed her hair into streaming tails. Before them, the red orb of the sun crested the horizon, burnishing the purple distance with orange and magenta. The pastures gradually gave way to cultivated land until the distances were thatched with young wheat, barley, and millet fields. They skirted small agrarian villages and the vast plantations that belonged to the houses of the congregate. As a concubine indentured to House Gonum, Serwe had been sequestered in similar villas, and as she stared at the rambling compounds, the roofs tiled in red clay and the rows of spear-like junipers, she was troubled that something once so familiar could become so threatening and strange. The slaves lifted their heads from the fields and watched them gallop along the dusty byways. Teamsters cursed them as they thundered past. Women dropped their burdens and yanked astonished children out of harm's way. What did these people think? Serwe wondered, her thoughts drunk with fatigue. What did they see? Daring fugitives, she decided. A man whose harsh face reminded them of Skilvendi terror. Another man whose blue eyes plumbed them in the haste of a single glance. And a beautiful woman, her long blonde hair askew, the prize these men would deny their unseen pursuers. By late afternoon, they urged their lathered horses to the summit of a stony hill, where the Skilvendi at last allowed them a momentary respite. Serwe nearly toppled from her saddle. She fell to the turf and stretched through the grasses, her ears ringing, the ground slowly wheeling beneath her. For a time, all she could do was breathe. Then she heard the Skilvendi curse.
Tenacious bastards, he spat. Whoever leads those men is as canny as he is stubborn.
What should we do? Kellis asked, and the question somehow disappointed her.
You know. You always know. Why do you cater to him?
She struggled to her feet, amazed that her limbs could so quickly stiffen, and then followed their gazes to the horizon. Beneath the rose sun, she glimpsed a small veil of dust trailing toward the river, but little more.
How many?
Neor asked Kellis. The same as before, 68, although they now ride different horses.
Different horses.
Neor repeated dryly, as though as disgusted by what this meant as by Kellis's ability to draw such conclusions.
They must have seized them somewhere on the way.
You fail to anticipate this?
68,
Neor said, ignoring his question.
Too many?
He asked, staring hard at Kellis. Too many.
Even if we attack at night?
Kellis nodded, his eyes strangely unfocused. Perhaps, he replied at length, but only if all other alternatives have been exhausted.
What alternatives?
Neor asked.
What should we do?
Serwe glimpsed a curious anguish in his expression.
Why does it trouble him so? Can't he see we're meant to follow?
We've gained some ground on them,
Kellis said firmly. We continue riding. With Kellis in the lead, they wound into the shadow of the hill, slowly gathering speed. They scattered a small herd of sheep, then pressed their long-suffering horses harder than ever before. Hurtling across the pasture, Serway felt the ache seep from her jerking limbs. They outran the hill's shadow, and the evening sun fell warm upon her back. She urged her horse faster and pulled even with Kellis, flashing him a fierce grin. He made her laugh with a funny face, eyes shocked at her audacity, brows pinched in indignant outrage. With a Skilvendi behind them, they galloped side by side, laughing at their hapless pursuers, until the evening passed into twilight, and the distant fields were rinsed of all color save gray. They had, she thought, outdistanced the very sun. Abruptly, her horse, her prize for having killed the scarred man, faltered mid-stride, throwing its head back with a grunting shriek. She could almost feel its heart burst, then exploding ground, grass and dirt between her teeth, and throbbing silence. The sound of approaching hoofs.
Leave her! She heard the Skilvendi bark. They want us, not her. She's stolen property to them, a pretty bauble.
I will not.
This is not like you, Dunyane. Not like you at all.
Perhaps, she heard Kellis say, his voice now very close and very gentle. Hands cupped her cheeks.
Kellis, no blue babies.
No blue babies, Serway. Our child will be pink and alive.
But she'll be safer.
Darkness and dreams of a great shadowy race across heathen lands. Floating.
Where's the knife?
Serway awoke, gasping for breath, the whole world rushing and bucking beneath her. Hair whisked and fluttered in her face, stinging her eyes. She smelled vomit.
This way!
She heard the Skilvendi shout over chopping hoofs, his voice impatient, even urgent.
The crest of that hill!
A man's strong back and shoulders were crushed against her breasts and cheek. Her arms were wrapped impossibly tight around his torso, and her hands. She couldn't feel her hands, but she could feel rope chafing at her wrists. She was tied, trussed to the back of a man, to Kellis. What was happening? She lifted her head, felt knives probe the back of her eyes. Headless pillars flashed by, and the dancing line of an amputated wall. Ruins of some kind, and beyond, the dark avenues of an olive grove. Olive groves? Had they come so far already? She looked back and was surprised by the absence of their riderless horses. Then, through thin skirts of dust, she saw a large cohort of horsemen darkening the near distance. The Kidra Hill, hard faces intent on the chase, long swords waving and flashing beneath the sun. They spilled around and through the ruined temple. She felt a giddy sense of weightlessness, then slammed into Kellis's back. The horse began kicking upward across a steep incline. She glimpsed the chalky remnants of a wall behind them.
Fuck!
She heard the Skilvendi roar. Then,
Kellis! You'll see them!
Kellis said nothing, but his back arched and his right arm jerked up as he heaved the horse in a different direction. She glimpsed his bearded profile as he glanced to his left.
Who are they?
He called. And Serway saw another surge of horsemen, more distant but sweeping toward them across the same slope. Kellis's horse yanked them at a tangent up the incline, kicking up gravel and dust. She looked back to the Kidra Hill below and watched them leap the ruined wall in staggered ranks. Then she saw another party, three horsemen, erupt from a stand of trees, then veer to intercept them on their way up the hill.
Kellis!
She cried, struggling against the ropes to secure his attention.
Still, Serway! Sit still!
One of the Kidra Hill toppled from his mount, clutching an arrow shaft in his chest. The Skilvendi, Serway realized, remembering the doe he'd killed. Without pause, however, the other two galloped past their fallen comrade. The first reined parallel to them, raised a javelin. The slope leveled, and the horses gathered speed. The Kidra Hill hurled the shaft across the mottled blur of ground and grasses. Serway winced. but somehow Kellis reached out and seized it from the air as though it were a plum hanging from a tree. In a single motion, he twirled the javelin and flung it back, where it punctured the man's astonished face. For a grisly moment, Serwe watched the man teeter in his saddle, then slump to the rushing ground. The other simply took his place, reining closer as though intending to ram them, his longsword raised to strike. For an instant, Serwe met his eyes, bright against his dusty face, mad with murderous determination. Bearing clenched teeth, he struck. Kellis's blow snapped through his body like the bowstring of some great siege engine. His sword flickered across the intervening space. Dropping his weapon, the Kidrahil glanced down. Bowel and bloody slop gushed across his pommel and thighs. His horse shied away and cantered to a halt. Then they were pounding down the far side of the summit, and the ground disappeared. Their horse shrieked and stumbled to a gravelly stop behind Neyur's mount. Before them yawned a steep drop, nearly three times the height of the trees that crowded its base. Not sheer, but far too steep for horses. A patchwork of dark groves and fields stretched into the hazy distance beyond.
"Along the crest,"
the Skilvendi spat, yanking his horse about. But he paused when Kellis's mount screamed once again. Before Serwe knew what was happening, her arms had been cut free and Kellis had vaulted to the ground. He hoisted her from the saddle and steadied her as she struggled to find her legs.
"We're going to slide down, Serwe. Can you do that?"
She thought she would vomit.
"But I can't feel my hand."
Just then the first of the Kidrahil leapt over the summit.
"Go!"
Kellis shouted, almost shoving her over the rounded edge. The dusty earth broke beneath her feet, and she began skidding down, but her screams were drowned by shrieks. A horse tumbled and thrashed in an avalanche of dust beside her. Clawing, scraping with fingers she could barely feel, she brought herself to a stop. The horse continued falling.
"Move, wench, move!"
the Skilvendi cried from above. She watched him half-pedal, half-skid past her, trailing a streamer of dust into the giddy emptiness below. She risked a hesitant step. Then she was falling again. She struggled, trying to keep her feet braced below her and her back to the slope, but she hit something hard and bounced outward in an explosion of sand, flailing at open air. Somehow she landed on her hands and knees, and for a moment it seemed she might break her descent, but another rock caught her left foot, jerked her knee to her chest, and she plummeted, battered and scraped, rolling headlong through a cloud. Amid the rattle of falling stones, she stopped, and the Skilvendi was cradling her head. The concern in his look bewildered her.
"Can you stand?"
he asked.
"Don't know,"
she gasped. "Where's Kellis?" He eased her to a seated position, but his concern was already elsewhere.
"Stay," he said brusquely. "Don't move."
He was drawing his sword even as he stood. She looked up the slope and immediately became dizzy. She saw a cloud of dust toppling down and realized that it was Kellis hastening his descent by making leap after sliding leap. Then the pain in her side struck her, something sharp, agonizing her every breath.
"How many?"
Neyur asked Kellis as he skidded to a halt. "Enough," he said, seemingly unwinded. "They won't follow us down this way. They'll go around."
"Like the others?"
"What others?"
"The dogs that surprised us when we first broke for the summit. They must have started down the moment we veered away from them, because I glimpsed only the stragglers, over there to the right."
Even as Neyur said this, Serwe heard the rumble of hooves through the screen of hardwoods.
"But we have no horses, no way to flee. What does this mean?"
she cried, gasping at the flare of pain that punished her. Kellis knelt before her, his heavenly face blotting out the sun. Once again she could see his halo, the shimmering gold that marked him apart from all other men.
"He'll save us. Don't worry, my sweet, I know he will."
But he said, "Serwe, when they come, I want you to close your eyes."
"But you're the promise,"
she said, sobbing. Kellis brushed her cheek, then wordlessly withdrew to take his place at the Skilvendi's side. She glimpsed flashes of movement beyond them, heard the neigh and snort of fierce war horses. Then, the first stallions, caparisoned in male skirts, stamped from shade into sunlight, bearing riders in white and blue surcoats and heavy hauberks. As the horsemen closed in a ragged semicircle, Serwe realized they possessed silver faces, as passionless as those of the gods, and she knew they had been sent to protect him, to shelter the promise. One drew closer than the others and pulled his helm from a shock of thick black hair. He tugged at two straps, then pulled the silver war mask from his stocky face. He was surprisingly young, and he sported the square-cut beard so common to the men of the Eastern Three Seas. Enonai, maybe, or Conryan. "I'm Cryjates Eresus," the young man said in heavily accented Shaic. "These pious but dour fellows are knights of Atrempus and men of the Tusk. Have you seen any fugitive criminals about?" Stunned silence. At last, Nayor said,
"Why do you ask?"
The knight looked askance at his comrades, then leaned forward in his saddle. His eyes twinkled.
"Because I'm dying for the lack of honest conversation."
The Skilvendi smiled.